History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, it is a certainty that there's some hidden history there as well. And we have the privilege of digging that up as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that pursuit, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And since we've arrived at that weekend that our country sets aside every year to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I thought we'd make that the theme of today's program. No, Dr. King did not serve in our armed forces during World War II. He wasn't quite old enough. In fact, he never was in the military and was famously critical of America's involvement in Vietnam. But a closer examination reveals that both Dr. King and the civil rights movement as a whole were greatly impacted by the example set by roughly 1 million African Americans who served our country in a then-segregated military in World War II. And that movement in the 50s and 60s even took some cues from courage displayed by those men in uniform on and off the battlefield. One of King's biggest influences was Dr. Ralph Abernathy, who had served in the Army in Italy during the war. Dr. Abernathy was asked to lead the Montgomery bus boycott, but deferred to King, thus kick-starting his crusade for equality. Those two would go to jail together 17 times, and it was Abernathy, that World War II veteran who held King's lifeless body after his assassination in 1968, and Abernathy who succeeded him as the leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dr. King recognized that Abernathy and the other African Americans in uniform in World War II had proven that they were just as American as anyone else. That if they were good enough to die for our country, how could they be denied equal protection under the law? Today, we're going to hear from three World War II veterans who fought our enemies abroad and discrimination at home, setting the stage for the breakthroughs to come. Let's start with the late Monty Irvin. You might know the name. He's a Baseball Hall of Famer. Born in Alabama as one of 13 children in a family loaded with athletic talent, he grew up in New Jersey, and get this, while playing college football, he moonlighted as a professional baseball player in the Negro Leagues, playing only road games under the pseudonym Jimmy Nelson so he wouldn't be found out. Barnstorming tours with major league stars made it clear that the players in his league could hold their own, but baseball's color barrier remained.
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team. They played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true. Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around and with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did, and by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Well, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you,
too. And guess
what?
Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go. Everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I was standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. And the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, I said, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be. Because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. And so I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yep.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, MVP down there. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife, but, you know, Uncle Sam called, said we had to go. I was drafted, spent my my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a few months, we caught the a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough. Even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships. And guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and rolling. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you were in
tragic.
The 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during in 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day, but we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came?
Yeah. We blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries because we knew that the Nazis, wanted to need fuel. My whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away. And if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We were so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, what I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II, who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and the people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers, mainly, and why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. You know, we were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly, nobody appreciated enough, to welcome us back home.
Well, I'm sure, on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before I went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and uh-huh. I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had inner ear problem. And 2 years, it got better. And then I, started to play like I had been playing. And selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how... I guess smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie, and we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Well, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole race
True.
Of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. He passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. And we're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
Again, that's the voice of the late Baseball Hall of Famer, Monty Irvin. Jackie Robinson was also in the Army in World War II and famously faced a court-martial after refusing to bow to discrimination and move further back on a bus because of his skin color. When we come back, we'll learn about another courageous stand taken by over 100 of the famous Tuskegee Airmen, the pioneering African-American pilots of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.